Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Go Read with Audio. I'm joined today by one of the authors of Future Value, Eric Longenhagen from Fangraphs. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, man. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to come on.
And your book, it came out last week, I believe. What was it? The 14th. And Future Value, the Battle for Baseball's Soul and How Teams Will Find the Next Superstar. You guys go to great depth to describe the scouting process and how you and your co-author Kylie McDaniel work on player evaluations. Can you kind of give our listeners an idea of what inspired you guys to write this book?
Well, it had been a while since there had been a sort of state of the industry examination of scouting. It is a fascinating thing that that a certain subset of baseball fan is interested in. And it's a thing that is at a kind of an inflection point right now, as especially now, like even in the few months since we turned in the manuscript and am now talking to you, like the landscape of this part of the baseball industry has really changed. And so we thought that, yeah, it was an opportune time. The publisher approached us and said, hey, we think that the medium sort of demands this right now, and that you and Kylie are the two who should do it. And we thought, sure, why not? And yeah, it had given us the opportunity to peel back the curtain on the stuff that he and I had learned over about 25 years combined doing this, from the people who have advised us and mentored us, and the people who have stories to tell of their own, some good, some bad, about their experiences in baseball, turning over rocks and finding players.
One of my favorite parts was just the amount of anecdotes that you guys got in there. And I was wondering how much of that was from your experience working as a scout, either for teams or for Fangraphs and other publications, and how much of that was from reporting and talking to the people you met while doing that work?
Yeah, it was a combination. There's just an endless well of great scouting stories. If we could like run cars off of them, it would be great for the environment. Like, there's just an endless supply of people driving in cars around, you know, rural unkempt neighborhoods trying to find players. Yeah, some of it is our own experience. Some of it is stuff that we, you know, our sources and contacts in baseball have told us that, you know, we just asked them to repeat on the record for the book. Some of them were open-ended questions, you know, from people we reached out to in baseball cold, or who folks who, as you know, you're talking to people about this type of thing and say, hey, what are some good scouting stories? Who are some people that you know who have good scouting stories? And I've still got a list of folks who my friends in baseball were like, yeah, you got to talk to this guy who worked on a league of their own and like was responsible for watching and teaching and evaluating the athletes in that movie who are playing baseball players, and, you know, taught Madonna and Rosie O'Donnell like how to do stuff to look more like, you know, a viable baseball player. Like, there's just all sorts of random stuff that, like in any job, you just cannot imagine you'd have to be asked to do, or situations that you weren't, you know, you've never had to handle before. And yeah, it's the amount of experiential knowledge that people in this industry have is incredible. And a lot of it is totally unusable now because, you know, the situations are so random. The idea that Howie Kendrick would not be known about by 28 of the teams today is kind of preposterous. But, you know, at the time when that is the case, you have to decide how as an organization you're going to handle it. And when he's the top player on your board for round after round after round of the draft, because no one else knows he exists, and you just have to be confident in that and keep passing on him because you know you can get him later. Like, that's just a once in a lifetime scenario. And so, yeah, some of that is in the book too. And you could just do a whole series of books based on scouts' stories. I'm surprised more of them don't have deals to write memoirs, candidly.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one thing that that struck me was you guys got not filtered opinions from a lot of people, and you share your own as well, which kind of came to light last week when the Red Sox punishment came down. In the book, you guys mentioned like people do not like the way that Houston treated their employees, and I just saw a huge parallel between that and how light the Red Sox punishment was for something pretty similar to what Houston did. And that kind of brings me to, you mentioned a state of the art for baseball, and your book really gets into that. It's not just about scouting. You break down the organizations and everything. And did you feel like you were peeling back a curtain, or did you guys have to like temper yourselves being still in the industry, still writing about this and having your contacts?
We prefaced literally the whole book by saying like, look, if you work for or root for a team in this book and there is unflattering stuff said, chances are that about all 30 teams somewhere in here, there is something like that. And it's just because it's the same as any other business or school or institution that employs a bunch of people. Like, people are going to screw up. People are going to make bad decisions and kind of show their ass. And it's, baseball is no exception. And that's part of what gives it character. And so, yeah, we do present some unvarnished opinions either from ourselves or people in the industry in the book. And there were times when some of the stuff, yeah, like Kylie and I would talk to one another, call or text each other in the middle of the night being like, I don't know, man, like, this guy's going to have our head over what I'm writing in this chapter. You know, like, I gotta be around these people, you know, on the Arizona backfields. I run into some of these folks a lot, you know, John Watson is around. But the stuff in the book is what we, you know, think is true. So, there's, you know, that's ultimately what we decided to do. And yeah, is there a chance that someone in the book, one day otherwise would have hired me to do something that now will not? Like, yeah, but that's okay.
Well, that's a great attitude to have when you're writing a book. And I really do think that it pays off because you guys, that honesty is really there. Now, at Let's Go Tribe, we're obviously concerned with the Indians. And your assessment of the Indians is that they're up there with the Yankees and Houston among teams using analytics the most. You do, towards the end of the book, bring it home and with your own idea about how things should be balanced. Do you think the Indians have a decent balance of scouting versus corporatization?
I think that they're definitely, if we're like on a scales of justice sort of situation here, it leans more toward the corporatization part of it. And some of that is not about the org's philosophy, but about the financial limitations imposed on the org.
Right.
And so the box that they have to operate in financially forces them to make decisions with efficiency in mind out of financial necessity. Again, this is owner imposed. Mm-hmm. More so than an ideology. Houston's operations were, they feel ideological in nature, or they did, you know, under Lou now. It seemed like there was maybe an axe to grind or a point to prove based on the way that the very top of that org interacted with old school baseball types. That's not the case with Cleveland. There is frustration over their lack of willingness to spend and what that means, not just for the way they go about acquiring talent, which is, you know, it would seem to me pretty model driven, especially in the draft. They're ending up with a lot of young players. They're ending up with a lot of buy low college guys who performed as sophomores, but not as juniors. They're ending up with a lot of high contact players, your Kai Toms of the world, your Stephen Kwans. I think that they're probably applying it to the international side as well. Jose Fermin, Jose Tena. These are high contact, up the middle type guys. They're pretty ubiquitous throughout the system. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is, you know, the patterns kind of show that this is a model driven team. But, you know, like I interviewed with Cleveland once upon a time, and the gauntlet I went through was scout heavy. It was a lot of people with decades of experience who had a lot of on-field experiential wisdom to share. I soaked it up over the course of those couple days, interviewing like all day. And the vibe I got is that those people are very much listened to within the org, but you can't apply that old school scout concept at a great scale without incurring great expense, because they have to travel and eat and do all that stuff. And a team like Cleveland is just less okay with that than a team like the Dodgers, that are just like, yeah, sure, these guys clearly have something to add to the way we go about doing this. Our pockets are bottomless. Just throw all the money at this. We'll have a giant scouting staff. Great. Cleveland is just less willing to do that type of thing. You know, they were one of the orgs that raised their voice about data sharing, rather than get into like an arms race of installing tech at amateur sites domestically and internationally, because they don't want to compete with the Dodgers and Yankees and all these other teams who are more willing to spend on that type of stuff to gain an individual advantage. And that is how baseball operates. They defer or rather diffuse those expenses among all 30 teams wherever possible. And yeah, Cleveland is also sort of at the forefront of that. So it is very corporate, but not in an ideological way. It is more something that I think was born out of necessity.
I really enjoyed the makeup chapter of the book, where you get into the way scouts can assess the things you can't find on a baseball field, or through the analytics that come from the new technology that's taking over the game. Is the more corporate feel, even with guys with great backgrounds in scouting, is that cutting short on the makeup aspect of scouting?
I think, yeah, this is a topic in the book that a lot of people, as we've talked about it, have gravitated toward. I do think makeup is important. The problem is that how I define it, how other people define it, is pretty variable person to person, and that's a problem. Mm-hmm. When part of the whole point of scouting is that I can go see a guy in California, and Kylie can see a guy in Georgia, and we can share reports and have an idea of who the better player is, both of us, even though we only saw one. Like the whole point of scouting is to communicate effectively with one another as like sort of one giant brain making decisions. And when all of your scouts have different ideas of what makeup is, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And it is not a thing that the industry, maybe, you know, team by team, certainly I think there is some of this, but we haven't seeked to define it. And so it is hard to wrangle the value of. And because of that, I think a lot of quants in the industry ignore it. The variation person to person in how they go about evaluating it and what it ultimately means is pretty hard to pin down. And so like defense early on during, you know, Saber 1.0, it's just ignored. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably wrong. You know, some of the more pragmatic points of view are you should do makeup work on early round picks or on big time trade acquisitions to make sure that you're not, just acquiring Josh Sally or any of these players, Lastings Millage, guys who clearly have stuff that you need to do digging on. And you could argue the Patriots should have done this with the kid who's got the weird militia tattoo,
yeah,
right? Like there are ways of avoiding this type of thing that you should care about. And some of the teams would tell you after like the third round of the draft, the chance that you get any kind of return at all from any of these players, regardless of their makeup, is pretty small. So why bother pumping resources into finding out if these players who are like mid to late round picks have bad makeup or not? If they do and you find out after you sign them, well, the chances are they weren't going to be anything anyway, so just cut them at that time. But again, like that is sort of a cynical view that has, you know, you are ultimately rewarding people who maybe have behaved in a way that is disqualifying. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you follow anything politically, but that's sort of a problem.
Yeah.
So it is tough because scouts are like anybody else. You know, that scouts can be bigoted or xenophobic. They can be hyper-religious and not like people who aren't. There's all sorts of stuff that the way they define makeup is kind of a problem. But I still think it's something that, as an industry, we need to think about. I do think it drives things. It can be a separator for individuals, but what exactly each of us means when we say it can be totally different, and that's a real, real problem.
Sure. Another thing you guys kind of make a point to say that this is what it is at the conclusion of the 2019 season. What you're writing is applicable to that, and the future is unknown. That's never been more true than right now. We're recording this in the middle of shelter at home across the nation, with no baseball going on at all. And I'm just wondering, you know, you make economic points throughout here that talk about that maybe make a good case for contracting the minors, which is coming up perhaps. For you talk about how an international draft might be instituted with the new CBA. What are the big things that you see that are going to be quickly antiquated from your book, from your reporting here?
Yeah, there's a section in the book that we added to throughout the process that was just like, what amongst this stuff might totally be made obsolete by changes to the way things are done soon? And it goes right on down from, yeah, you mentioned international draft, which I think is highly probable by 2023. Kylie would tell you 2022. Mm-hmm. So like we are sort of in a weird fight about that, but but so there's that kind of stuff. And then also like, hey, are there going to be robo strike zones in 2 years? And all of a sudden framing doesn't matter anymore. And the way we evaluate catchers as an industry totally changes. And so, what type of technology is installed in these ballparks as we move from TrackMan to Hawkeye? What does that mean for the way we're evaluating players with tech? And yeah, the minor league contraction thing, it's sad. Could MLB owners just pay all of these minor leaguers a living wage and keep the number of affiliates what they are right now? Like, yeah, they could do that and I would prefer it. But I think that a lot of the discussion around the minor league contraction stuff has lacked nuance, and that minor league baseball is not this pure, innocent expression of baseball that people seem to think it is. I understand that walking in the door for $6, $8, whatever it is much easier for a lot of families than going to a big league game, and that's really, really important. But some of the other stuff around minor league baseball contraction, like you walk into the ballpark and you're still inundated with advertising. At every turn, the entire ballpark is just blanketed in advertising, which I greatly dislike. Mm-hmm. And beers are still $7. Like, it's not this utopia. And the labor force at minor league baseball games is absolutely being taken advantage of. I was one of them for several years. Like, I have, I made $25 a day working for the minor league team that I did 10 plus years ago, whenever it was. Mm-hmm. And so there are problems with minor league baseball. And so I'm a little less caught up about like seeing some of the franchises locked off, because they are ultimately owned by people who own a professional sports team, like they're not, they're doing fine, most of them. And the impact of the employment of the people at the ballpark, like, yes, retired teachers, young people looking for summer work, that it sucks that they're not going to be able to have that anymore. But in general, the economic impact of these minor league stadiums and complexes are greatly overstated, the same way that professional, like the NBA stadiums and entertainment complexes, their economic impact is overstated as well, in attempt to acquire tax money to help build them. So I have very mixed feelings about minor league contraction, but I think absolutely with this pandemic and what it's going to do to baseball this season, it's a very convenient time for MLB to enact it. Mm-hmm. And that it is surely going to happen.
Yeah. One thing that you and Kylie seem to agree upon is that scouting will have a role in the future, that it works best when integrated with the new technology and everything and the analytics. Do you think that that's still true in light of the pandemic, where we've shut down scouting because there's no baseball?
Yeah. How our lives change based on how much we are willing to and able to travel might impact the way scouting is done. But having running Nike running shoes on the ground, I was going to say boots on the ground, which is like a thing I say a lot for scouts, but very few of them wear boots, and a lot of them just wear Nikes. But yeah, like having intel, having dope and like dirt on players and coaches and front offices, and having a better understanding of why things are happening, stuff that can't be explained by some of this data. A TrackMan unit tells you a lot about what a pitcher is capable of, like a lot. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times it doesn't tell you why. And I just think that's very important. I think that there are spaces in which scouts are still valuable and can operate. Are some of the places that they previously were less valuable? Yeah, like as data collectors who go to a game and chart every fastball a guy throws, or even just tell you what the range of the fastballs were, like those, we have other stuff that does that now. There, we have to be willing and open-minded to shift our focus and the way we scout, the way we think about how to hire scouts. That stuff's got to shift, or they will just go away. Mm-hmm. Being resistant to this stuff and stubborn is, you know, from the 2000s to now, based on the way analytics have occupied parts of baseball, that's a bad idea, to be stubborn and unwilling to change or think about stuff in a new way. Those folks are mostly out of baseball now, if that's what they were like. And so kind of have to roll with these punches too. Tech is absolutely occupying a greater part of the picture. But I think gathering intel and providing context for why someone is good, bad, or not, what is going on at home, at school, with the diet, with, you know, the kid's relationship with his coaches, all of these things are very important contextual details. They're the reasons that players are over or undervalued or slip through the cracks. And the players who haven't played a lot, who are hurt and aren't generating a huge statistical sample or a huge sample for the technology to see and be confident in. Like, those are also players who you need eyes to see. So yeah, I think that there's absolutely plenty of room for lots and lots of scouts in the future. It's just about MLB owners being willing to have an employee base that large. And a lot of times the types of GMs who are hired now, you know, Brandon Taubman with the Astros was supposedly on the short list of candidates to fill some of the vacant GM jobs this offseason before he besmirched himself, you know? Mm-hmm. So when you walk into a meeting with a GM, or with an owner rather, to be the GM and tell him, I can recreate your scouting staff 80% of the way as far as quality goes for 20% of the cost, the owner's going to listen, you know? Mm-hmm. So I, you know, that's a problem too, is owners have incentive to install guys into that GM slot who want to save them money. They're just going to get preferential treatment in the interviews, because that's what owners want to hear. They don't want to hear that you're going to spend a butt ton of money.
Right.
Like you have to be Stanley Kubrick to walk into the studio and say, you know, back up the Brinks truck for me, baby. I'm making 2001. Like it takes a heavy hand to demand that. And when you want to be a GM, you don't have that. You know, if you have the kind of gravitas, you probably are one already. So, it's a tough situation to be in. I am worried for the scouting industry here in the near future, especially if there's no baseball this year, that they're going to be it's going to change in a way that a lot of that is bad for a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's all the questions that I had prepared. Is there anything else about the book that you would like to share?
Gosh, I don't know. I just thanks, you know, for people who have picked it up or are considering doing it. It is a thing that that Kylie and I worked really hard on, and that it occurred at a time for the two of us that was, you know, this is like the last thing that we kind of, that we did together, basically,
mm-hmm.
Before he moved on to ESPN. And so if you find one with the cover where it still says Kylie McDaniel of Fangraphs, then congrats, you have like a collector's item. But yeah, like there was a lot put into it, and I appreciate people's consideration. There are a lot of people who write books, and it is quite an undertaking, and all of them deserve your consideration. But yeah, this has been my pitch. I don't know. Do you want to talk about any Indians prospect stuff?
Sure. If you've got a little more time and you want to talk, I noticed.
I'd say,
go ahead.
My list of the dudes in the system will be out within the next week or so. And it's going to be deep. There's like a lot of pitching in the system. I've been going through it today. And yeah, so check that out at the site in the next week or so, the Indians prospect list top to bottom. It's going to be quite a task to do here based on what I'm uncovering based on all the pitching in the system. So yeah, if you like the Indians, that'll be up on the site soon.
Now, in the book, you mentioned that, you know, some teams are kind of leaning into one area, you know, they can kind of see a focus. And it, if I remember correctly, you kind of pointed out the Shane Bieber profile, the command artists where you can add velocity as you go along. Is that what you're seeing among Indians prospects for pitchers?
I certainly at the lowest levels, no. The lowest levels, the guys I watch in the backfields, like they chuck it and they don't really have a great idea where it's going. There are a lot of guys, and that's just part of having a couple DSL teams, part of having a couple AZL teams. When you have this many young teenage pitchers, like just many of them are not going to be good strike throwers. And so that's what I've put on the draft side. Yes, I do think that Cleveland is good at identifying traits that help the fastball play, that they do find guys whose Shane Bieber is a great example of this, whose breaking ball is visually closer to average. It is not like clearly an elite pitch visually, but his ability to locate that slider consistently to at a point where it is enticing to hitters, but also unhittable. That makes his slider play like an elite pitch. And I think they're particularly good at finding guys who can do that. Most of the time, it's been changeup guys. It's been the Eli Morgan types
mm-hmm.
who throw a ton of strikes. They have a great changeup. And this is just a pitcher who the industry tends to undervalue. I know I do. Like, we are just biased toward guys with breaking balls in this industry because you can't really teach it. And this is a way that Cleveland has zigged while everyone else has zagged. There are just a bunch of college strike throwing changeup guys in the system. But yeah, they've been pretty good developing velo for a while too. They were early weighted ball adopters. And I think that's part of, you know, you see it unabashedly on the backfields. There are just plyo balls laying all over the place. So yeah, it's I think the org is very, very good at developing pitchers. Some of it is kind of messy. There are a lot of these arm strength dudes in the system who have no idea where it's going. but yeah, like I'd rather that they throw hard than not. And among these guys who throw hard and don't know where it's going, a couple of them are going to figure it out. It's going to be pretty big.
On the position player side, you mentioned that they've got the up the middle guys. And I know at our site, we've been pretty excited about George Valera, Brian Rocchio, where they've maybe not gotten the hype from other sites. Is that maybe something you're seeing their stock rising, or are there other guys that you're even higher on?
Well, I mean, I like both of those guys. Yeah, Rocchio and Valera both have been prominently placed on my pref list in the org for a while now. I mean, you know, Rocchio mm-hmm. is like, I was lucky enough to watch him be incredible in the AZL.
Mm-hmm.
and just, yeah, like stuff him pretty good early on. But yeah, that's, you know, Nolan Jones is sort of polarizing depending on who you talk to. He is athletic. He's kept that body in check. He obviously has a great eye for the strike zone and ridiculous power. His splits against lefties are horrendous, and there are people who think that he's going to be limited to some sort of part-time role because that is so severe. You mentioned Valera. Yeah, Valera's got a sweet swing. He's very polished in center field. He doesn't run great, but his instincts in center are good. So he's got a chance to stay there very probably. Daniel Johnson is tooled up, so there are people in baseball who think that he's a solid everyday player, slightly above. And then you have all of the high school pitching in the system, Hankins, Espino, that is just sort of a dice roll, right? But it, you know, they might turn out to be huge as well. James Karinchak is going to be a dominant reliever right away. Gosh, who else? Gabriel Rodriguez and Junior Santeaton. I love those two guys. They are going to be stuffed on the org list. I have both of them ahead of Hankins.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm not a huge Hankins guy. The arm strength is all the way back. He was 93, 95, touch of 7 last year. But just as I've continued to learn about what works and what doesn't from a pitching perspective, lower slot guys like Hankins, their fastballs tend to play down a little bit just because of the type of movement. Whereas the over the top guys, like you'll see hopefully this year with Karinchak, those guys are like, though their fastballs play above their what you'd expect given their velocity. So yeah, I'm a little lower on Hankins than I think the industry mean is, just based on stuff like that and kind of where his body's at already. And yeah, like, it's a deep org. You mentioned the middle, up the middle guys. They do love contact oriented up the middle guys. Tyler Freeman, I mentioned Tana, Jose Fermin. There, it's, you know, Yordi Valdez was young for the draft. Jonathan Rodriguez was young for the draft. Quinton Holmes was young for the draft class. These are all tendencies clearly that the org has, in my opinion. And I'll talk about that again in the system overview at the bottom of the coming prospect list.
Cool. That was really cool. I mean, I appreciate you sharing that insight into what you're putting on your prospect lists and on the board at Fangraphs. Thank you once again. I won't take up any more of your time. My guest, Eric Longenhagen from Fangraphs, co-author of Future Value with Kylie McDaniel, which is out now. Highly encourage everyone to find themselves a copy and read it. It's a great book. And thank you, Eric, for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right.